Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with the next in our series of guest presenters, Christine Ottery. Christine Ottery is a journalist and blogger, published on theguardian.co.uk and Comment is Free, Times Online, newscientist.com and theecologist.co.uk. She is also a researcher for George Monbiot and a multimedia science journalism MA student at City University. In this show, Christine and I talk to animal researcher Jonathan Balcombe.
Jonathan Balcombe is here to speak to us today. He's an animal behaviour research scientist affiliated with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He's just published a book called Second Nature and previously also published a book called The Pleasurable Kingdom on how animals enjoy hedonistic delights. Hello, Jonathan. Thanks for talking to us today.
Hi, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us a bit about how you got into animal behaviour research?
I think the first step for me was birth. From my earliest memory, I've been fascinated by animals. So growing up, I realized that I really wanted to devote my life to animals, and I've never lost that passion. In fact, I feel as if as I learn more about animals, my fascination grows. So I never miss an opportunity to go bird watching or nature watching wherever I am, be it out in the country or in inner London.
Tell us about how you actually became to be researching animal behavior.
Well, I've always been drawn especially to the less popular animals. So I did an undergraduate degree in biology and then I knew I wanted to continue on and do a master's degree and PhD. And so I thought, well, what are the least popular animals? We've got spiders, scorpions, snakes, bats. So I wrote letters to snake biologists and bat biologists, and a Canadian, a preeminent Canadian bat biologist took an interest in me. So I ended up studying communication in bats for about 6 years. A fascinating group of animals, incredibly diverse. I mean, one in every four mammals is a bat. And they are just a nice illustration, really, of the broader message of second nature, the inner lives of animals, because they have very sophisticated communication systems and they're sort of outside of our radar because their sensory systems are so different to ours. They share vision and hearing and taste and touch and smell. They have all those basic senses, but they orient with this thing called echolocation. So I devote quite a few pages in Second Nature to the inner lives of bats.
So let's look at... The argument in the book is slightly more nuanced than this, but let's get into it looking at animal intelligence. How do we define intelligence? And I suppose, why did it come to be seen? Why is it a desirable trait in the first place?
I mean, intelligence is adaptive. It allows you to respond flexibly to changes in your environment. And that's the nature of nature. It is a dynamic place. So being able to be flexible and on your toes, so to speak, is useful. We are an intelligence-centric species. This is a term I use to sort of describe how we tend to be very intelligence-focused, and we tend to give a lot of weight to intelligence in terms of moral questions. One of my key arguments is that intelligence, and this is not a new idea, I don't claim it for myself, it's been discussed by other thinkers for a long time, and that is that intelligence is only one aspect of sentience, and sentience is the capacity to feel things, you know, pleasures and pains and different types of emotions and things like that. And I think sentience is where the rubber meets the road in terms of moral questions about how we treat animals, and we may get into that. But certainly animals are much more intelligent than we used to think. The study of animal minds and animal feelings was considered taboo in scientific circles for much of the 20th century. And fortunately, that's changed. And now we have a journal published in the UK called Animal Cognition, for instance. So every month you have new studies about animal thinking coming out. We also tend to be kind of anthropomorphic or anthropocentric in our assessment of other animals' intentions. intelligence. As you implied in your question, animals have different intelligences. They have intelligence that's useful to them. So, for instance, the Clark's nutcracker, which is a kind of corvid, a relative of the crow, lives in mountainous regions in North America. It has to store nuts and seeds to find in the winter, because in the winter things are buried under the snow and a lot of this food is not available. So they cache them. And not surprisingly, they have a superb spatial memory and they can remember the locations of up to 33,000 different items that they've buried. It's probably something they can do better than us. I often forget where my watch is. That's only one item. In fact, I lost my cell phone today. It's been relocated. So, you know, often animals are very good at what's important to them evolutionarily. And sometimes they're better than us in domains of raw intelligence. And I do describe studies with chimpanzees who have superb spatial memory and they can remember where 9 digits displayed at random on a computer screen that disappear after 1/2 of a second. They can remember them all in order. We're lucky if we can get to 3 or 4 out of the 9.
And what about the issue of language? I mean, some people would posit that language is what sets us apart from animals. And what do you think the significance of language is?
Yeah, I mean, there's still quite a few language supremacists out there, and there's no question that our language is highly sophisticated and allows us to do and communicate certain things in more sophisticated ways than perhaps other animals can. But it's not like we've cornered the market on language. I mean, even the honeybee has symbolic language where they can communicate information that's separate in time and space from where they actually are at the time. I'm not trying to suggest that honeybees are sentient in the way that we are necessarily, or that we should think of them as our equals. But nonetheless, you know, language is sort of more a matter of degree than kind, as Darwin would have said. I do discuss communication in animals at some length. I'll give one example of prairie dogs, which are these mid-sized rodents of the prairie provinces, the grasslands of North America. And they, unfortunately for them, they have a lot of enemies, and they have evolved quite a sophisticated alarm calling system, semantically relevant calls that they make for different types of predators. So if an eagle flies over, there's an eagle-type call is made, and they all run for the burrows and hide under the burrow. And then if it's a coyote, then they go to the burrow and wait at the top, looking around alertly. If it's just a domestic dog, which is more predictable, then they'll just stay where they are and be alert. If somebody is carrying a gun, they modify the call to indicate that the human is carrying a gun. If someone's wearing a yellow shirt, they'll modify the call then. So they have about 100 different modifiers. So it's a remarkably sophisticated alarm calling system. Do we call it language? I would say, we could argue about that, but that's of only ancillary relevance to the question of sentience, as we mentioned earlier.
Let's go back to the question of sentience. And if we're talking about dividing sentience from intelligence, there's obviously a much smaller scope for looking at animals that would have some vaguely human-like intelligence. But clearly sentience is something that is, you know, a much wider spectrum. But then how far back do we take that? There's a section in the book where you describe, for instance, you know, trees having a complex form of intelligence would be the wrong word, but you know, there's mechanisms by which they, you know, they release their seeds, and you know, you can look at like things like orchids and the relationship that a lot of orchids have with their pollinators. In that, you know, some disguise themselves as types of moths. Clearly, there has got to be some sort of line that's drawn where we say beyond this line of sentience. I suppose, you know, I'm sort of getting at really stuff that we decide we'd like to eat.
I understand the question. I mean, the question of line drawing is a question we can debate. And, is a cockroach sentient or not? I certainly wouldn't argue any plants are sentient, and which is not to say we shouldn't respect them and be considerate about them. But what I think is key there is that some animals, I think we can pretty much most of us, if not all of us, can agree on, fall above that key line of sentience that matters morally. I would say most people would agree that mammals, all of our fellow mammals, you know, the warm-blooded furry that nurse the young with milk, they are all sentient in the morally relevant way. I would argue all vertebrates are, and I spend quite a bit of pages talking about fish. There's a new book called Do Fish Feel Pain, by the way, which concludes, based on the evidence, they can feel pain, and there's many reasons why we should expect that. So, you know, I think the key there is that even though we may debate where to draw the line, we should draw it in pencil, for one thing, because it's a difficult line to draw, and as information comes to light, we may need to change its location. Yes, but certain animals clearly fall above that line.
And in terms of suffering, which you're talking about, I mean, it might seem like nothing new to dog or cat owners that they think that animals have feelings. So how can we actually describe that in terms of science? How can we know through research what animals are thinking and feeling?
Yeah, there's a number of ways we can explore the depths of suffering and these types of forms of sentience. And it is a challenge. And one of the reasons science neglected it for so long was because these feelings are what's called private experiences. they're subtle, they're nuanced, they're internal. That's why the subtitle of my book is The Inner Lives of Animals, and it is a challenge to explore those. But science is incredibly innovative, and we can come up with ways of exploring that. For example, baboons are known to show changes in their blood chemistry that reflects when they lose an infant, a baboon mother. She has increased glucocorticoid hormones for a month or more following the loss of the infant, and this reflects what women feel when, or at least the change in their physiology, which is clearly accompanied by feelings of grief in the women. So the assumption is that the baboons probably have a similar sort of feeling of grief. And just as women expand their social networks after this loss, they seek therapy, we send flowers to each other, we get cards, and you know, people rally around. Similarly, these baboons will expand their social networks, more grooming, more being groomed. Their closest friends in the community also show elevated levels of glucocorticoid hormones, and probably through an osmotic effect, also some level of grief. So it's an example of an animal, and this is really a profound implication of this sort of study. And there's another one I describe at some length in my book on starlings that show they can become pessimistic or optimistic outlook on life. And I think a really important message from those studies is, which contradicts a common assumption about our views of animals, that they don't just live in the moment. They're not just here now. They're not just stimulus response things. They actually have a tenor of life. They have a quality of life. They have dispositions and moods. They have a life that can go well or ill according to their circumstances. And I think the moral ramifications of that are pretty significant.
Before I read this book, I sat down and made a list of a number of things that we would commonly discuss as separating human beings from the rest of the animals. And so it was great going through the book then to see how many of these were discussed. And you talked about research that I had no idea about. And one of these that I'd like to discuss in more detail is the idea that we as human beings have a sense of our place in a wider world, so we're aware of other human beings, and we're aware that those other human beings have feelings and thoughts and intelligence the same that we do. And you know, there is discussion of research in the book talking about how actually animals do the same thing.
Yeah, I'll give one example of this sort of awareness of others. A study of elephants done in Africa, wild elephants. These animals are long-lived, as we know. They have a reputation for having good memories, and in fact that reputation is borne out by scientific study. They have excellent memories, and they live in matriarchal groups, and it turns out a given elephant will be keeping mental tabs on up to 30 or more of other elephants in their local community at any one time. One of the somewhat comical studies that was done to sort of test spatial awareness and awareness of the location and identity of other elephants was done by a research team in which they collected urine that had been deposited into the sand. They dug up the sand and quickly carried it and put it in the path of the walking elephants as they were moving from one place to another. And if they took urine from an elephant who was walking ahead of the elephants who were going to be tested and put it in front of these elephants, the elephants would notice the urine and sniff it and just check out who it was. But if they deposited urine that was from elephants walking behind them and they put that in front of the elephants would show a much more pronounced response, more indications of surprise. And this is the term the scientists use. It didn't fit expectations, because an elephant walking behind you, you don't expect to smell their urine in front of you. So, you know, a clever little experiment that indicates that these animals, they have a mental map of who's who and who's where. Other studies show that animals, including meadow voles, a very, very small mammal, scrub jays, and other animals, so birds and mammals, they have what's called episodic memory. They can remember the what, the when, and the where of a past event. And it could be 5-6 days later, and they have relevant memory, so they can remember what is what based on the past experience from several days earlier.
You describe an experiment which shows that chimpanzees can be seen to understand an event from another chimpanzee's point of view as well.
Yes, one study that's relevant to that, and there's probably been a number with chimps, but there's also the one that comes to mind is with chimps and humans. For instance, I think it was something like the human there was some food nearby, and the human was sitting there and not aware of the food, and the chimp knew that, and the chimp could see that the human wasn't aware. And there were two sources of food, and one source was in a rattly box that would make a lot of noise when the chimp grabbed it. The other one was in a very quiet container. And the human was, if the human was blindfolded, for instance, say, the chimp would be very careful about selecting from the quiet one, because the chimp knows that the human can still hear. Whereas if the human had earplugs or was clearly their ears were covered, they might choose from either one, because the hearing didn't matter. They knew the human wasn't going to hear them. So this is the sort of attribution of mental states to another. I think maybe the one you were talking about is where a subordinate chimp in the social hierarchy was able to see where food was hidden in an arena. And there's a chimp on the other side looking through a glass that, from that chimp's perspective, if you think of this perspective, would not be able to see where that food was hidden. And the chimp would respond to that food when given the opportunity to get it quite differently than if the chimp knew that the other chimp knew where it was. So chimps have big brains, a very, very tense social network. If you step out of line and you're a chimp, you could get in trouble. You might get bitten or slapped or whatever. And so they're acutely aware of their spatial surroundings, a little bit like the elephants. And it might be partly why they have been shown to have a superior short-term spatial memory than humans have on numerical studies.
One of the main threads in the book seems to argue that animals have complex relationships with each other. They cooperate and they're even altruistic. And so are you a supporter of the theory of social evolution? And what does that mean for animals and even for humans?
Yeah, I think this is a new frontier in the study of animal behavior, and that is the notion of animals being virtuous, animal virtue. It's not a term that's been applied to non-humans until very recently. But social living requires compromise, restraint. It requires acting in a way, or at least the individual benefits by being considerate of others, because the notion of reciprocal altruism, which is a term that's been around now for about 30 years, is founded on the idea that individuals remember a past good deed. So there's the kin selection basis of doing good by others, which is that they share genetic material, and therefore by helping them, you're actually improving your inclusive fitness in the genetic sense. So that's one theoretical basis for animals being good to each other. But then, quite aside from kin selection, you have reciprocal altruism, where non-relatives will still act altruistically. And the general explanation for that is that, well, a good deed earns a good deed. So other individuals will remember a past good deed and they may trade that in. Chickens, roosters will make a call, a very virtuous call, where they find food in the grass and they'll make a call. If there's a grasshopper there, they'll make the special come hither call. They'll only make that call if there's a hen in the vicinity. And the hen recognizes the call. She comes running. The rooster gallantly shows where the food is. The hen will eat the food. And presumably, there's some payback, and in fact, it may be a week later that hen will remember and allow that rooster, say, to mate with her. So, that might be the type of trade-off that's going on. However, you also have, exploitation of virtue, where sometimes roosters will make a false come-hither call. There's nothing there, but the rooster makes the call, and studies show that roosters will not make this call unless their hens are far enough away that they won't detect the ruse. Hen comes running, doesn't find anything. Well, grasshoppers can jump away, so the rooster may be able to get away with it. So it's an example of a deceptive call, which may be a little bit less moral, but of course we humans know all about deception and less virtuous behavior. But it's important to note that deception only works if most of us are honest most of the time. So social systems tend to promote virtuous behavior. It doesn't mean that everyone's routinely virtuous around the clock. And by the way, the hens are just as perceptive of roosters. They will recognize an inveterate cheater and they'll start to ignore him. So natural selection tends to favor virtue.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Christine Ottery, and we're talking to Jonathan Balcombe about his book Second Nature. So, Jonathan, one of the, I suppose, more strikingly obvious aspects of looking at the welfare of animals from a moral perspective is the capacity of animals to feel pain. And I suppose a more conventional way of looking at this would be that pain is somehow connected to a higher sort of intelligence functioning.
Yeah, I mean, I believe pain and sentience more generally is the bedrock of ethics. The reason another individual's life matters is because their life can be made better or worse by their circumstances. And we recognize that within our own species. And I think we really need to come to grips with the fact that other animals can be just as sentient as us. And this is not a new idea, but it has profound moral implications. And I want to reiterate this point by quoting from two individuals who've spoken to this at different times in the past. One was Humphrey Primett, a British cleric from the 18th century, who said, in typical language of his time, very eloquently, quote, "Superiority of rank or station exempts no creature from the sensibility of pain, nor does inferiority render the feelings thereof the less exquisite," end quote. More recently, we have a British biologist named John Webster, who says somewhat less tactfully, quote, "People have assumed intelligence is linked to the ability to suffer, and that because animals have smaller brains, they suffer less than humans. That is a pathetic piece of logic," end quote. So I quote these two individuals in my book because I do believe that sentience is the bedrock of ethics. It's the basis for moral systems, ultimately speaking. And I think we need to, that's why we as moral beings, as a moral species, and we can argue about whether other animals are moral, and we've talked about the virtue, that's why we as humans need to include animals in our circle of moral concern.
In Second Nature, you state that some animals could possibly feel more pain than humans. Can you explain a bit about that? How that's manifested as well?
There's no reason, just really speaking back to those quotes, there's no scientific reason in my mind that the sensibility to pain maps clearly onto intelligence. And that's kind of the assumption, the tacit assumption we've made, if we're thinking about it at all. We're smarter, therefore pain is more pronounced to us. But that's not at all clear to me. Other animals need to be able to feel things in their environments just as much. There's no, evolution is an indifferent thing. It's not a moral process. But we're not talking about evolution. We were talking about the evolution of sensory systems. But there's no reason why evolution should value sensibility to pain in a mouse any less than sensibility to pain in a human. I guess that's my point there. Now, I will say this. I think our language, our sophisticated language, perhaps has caused us to develop certain emotional experiences that perhaps is not the province of other species. On the other hand, given that other animals live in different sensory and social milieus, they too may develop certain types of feelings and emotions that we're not party to. We need to be very open that we haven't cornered the market on all the feelings that are out there. So we need to have a more inclusive view of animal sentience and animal emotionality.
I'd suggest perhaps the part of the book that Christine was referring to there, you quote an ethologist talking about fish and the idea that perhaps, because fish might be feeling pain always in the moment, so they don't have any sort of concept of that pain ending at some point.
I see, yes.
Which is, well, I was going to look at that from the opposite, in that the humans not have both anticipation and memory of pain as well, so perhaps the fear of pain. But you do then go on to explore how animals also can have the sort of...
That's right. I quote a number of biologists on that sort of question. Donald Broom, a biologist based at Cambridge University, quite prominent in his work. You know, he claims that fish may feel pain in a worse way than we do because of, as you say, they may not know the cause of it or when it's going to end. An ethicist named Bernard Rollin in the United States also has suggested that other species may have a worse experience of certain noxious events because they don't understand that it's going to end. We go to the doctor or the dentist. We actually know it's in our best interest. We don't like the pain, but we know it's a needle and it's going to anesthetize us, for instance. They may not know any of that. So, yes, but I do want to address the assumption that the fish may not have any memory or anticipation. And this is part of why these studies on baboons and starlings with pessimism and optimism and grief. And fish, it turns out, actually do have long-term memories. That's been debunked. The old notion of the 3-second memory of the goldfish has been fully debunked now in cognitive studies of fishes. They may actually be able to anticipate bad events, and their experience of time may be sort of a flow rather than just an instantaneous experience. We need to be open to that, and hopefully science will shed more light on that.
There's a preconception that life in nature is harsh and cruel, and you quote Tennyson's famous nature being red in tooth and claw, and you aim to challenge that view. So let's perhaps talk about how you do that.
Yeah, I think the public is fed a skewed perception of wild nature from things like nature documentaries, which tend to focus on the dramatic predator-prey relationships because it sells more. It's a better marketing tool. In fact, just as an illustration, the new series Life that is just starting to air in the U.S., I gather it's been airing here. We have a different narrator than you have here. I must say I prefer David Attenborough. But in any event, that I watched the first 2 hours of that, and predictably, visually splendorous. I mean, fabulous, great technology, great photography, very patient photographers. I admire them for that. But I thought it really had a dearth of portraying the inner lives of animals. It didn't really say much about cognition and thinking and experience and emotions. There was some there that was relevant to that, and that was good to see. But there's more, the word instinct got mentioned a lot. So I do spend some time. I do want to challenge this popular notion that nature is red in tooth and claw and that it's harsh and earnest. This resonates with my earlier book, Pleasurable Kingdom, too. I broach it a little bit there. I think we need a more nuanced, a more gracious view of wild nature, one that realizes that animals have good moments as well. They have lives worth living. To use the philosophical jargon, they have intrinsic value. And if an animal has intrinsic value, then that goes beyond any kind of utilitarian value the animal has to us. So we may say a cow has a value as a source of milk and meat. But if the cow has intrinsic value, then the cow's own considerations have to be taken into account, because the cow has a life worth living to herself. And so that obviously has big moral implications.
And what kind of implications does that have? I mean, if you could place a value, if you could measure somehow how much an animal's life is worth, what would that mean for us as humans?
Right. I mean, this gets to the real crux of the moral issue, which is how does our view of animals affect how we should treat them, which I think you mentioned, Neil, at the very outset. If animals are sentient, then we need to think about how our behavior affects them. So, and we can do that. We're a reflective species, and we're a moral species. And I argue that we need to include animals in our circle of moral concern, and that means thinking twice about what we buy at the supermarket, thinking twice about what we buy at the drugstore, whether it's been tested on animals or not, whether it has animal ingredients. I personally chose to stop eating animals about 25 years ago, and I now pretty much vegan. I avoid animal products as much as I can. And it's a lifestyle decision that, frankly, for me, living in the West especially, is not a difficult one to pursue. And it's a process. I know it's threatening to people, to many people, to think about the prospect of becoming vegan. And I don't mean to use that word as sort of a member of the club, and either you are or you aren't. We can all make a personal contribution to the betterment of animal lives through our personal choices day in, day out. And that's one of the take-home messages of my book, I hope, is to encourage people to step back and think about the decisions they make. And there's a lot of reasons to eat lower on the food chain beyond animal sentience, although that's a key one. I mean, it's also good for the environment and good for one's, tends to be good for one's personal health. So I hope people will make that connection.
Historically, philosophers, Aristotle to Descartes, have always viewed animals as being as a completely separate level to human beings. And I think we're much more likely nowadays to feel that, you know, humans are just another animal. But of course, the irony there is that it's because we have this capacity to think about these issues from a moral perspective that does make us into, you know, something that's different from the other animals. And of course, something that isn't part of this discussion are the animals themselves. So while we can make the moral decision to not eat meat, presumably a lion or a shark doesn't have that ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like to say, pardon the pun, but I like to say that this new knowledge we have about animals is helping to put the horse before Descartes. And, the fact is that animals are not morally neutral. They do have a sense of fairness awareness. For instance, studies with dogs and monkeys will show that they are averse to unfair treatment and they will refuse to cooperate. I'm not suggesting that that dogs are incipient philosophers and that they can discuss moral issues, and you're right, they cannot engage in those discussions. But this, I guess, the philosophical jargon that relates here to this is the difference between a moral agent and a moral patient. And a moral agent, such as a human, is one who has a sense of morals and can make moral decisions. And a moral patient is one who perhaps cannot do that, but nonetheless is worthy of moral consideration of others. Human infants, young human children, mentally enfeebled humans would be examples of humans who are not moral agents, but they're moral patients. And our moral systems uphold basic rights to those individuals. I'm arguing that, and I'm, by the way, I'm not arguing that animals are somehow incomplete or that they sort of, you know, they should be thought of as less functional. They're complete in their own way. But I'm arguing that as moral patients, they should be accorded the same sort of respect and consideration that, say, human moral agents, moral patients are afforded.
And one of the really interesting parts of the book was describing how animals, in fact, do take care of animals that are disabled or have been injured. And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say it was for me, too. I haven't done these studies, and I've read them in other books on primate behavior. I'll give one illustration of that. It gets back to sort of the virtue we talked about earlier. Mozu was a Japanese macaque who was born with a defect, a severe defect, of no hands and no feet. And of course, monkeys use their hands and feet to eat and climb, and you might expect that an animal with that sort of handicap is doomed. In fact, Mozu, thanks to living in a social group where others rallied around and gave her support, she lived a long, full life. She had, I believe, 4 infants who she raised to be adults, which is a pretty productive life for one of these monkeys. And she did so, obviously, not because of her own wherewithal, although she had plenty of that, but she did so because of the virtuous behavior of others in her group.
there's another side to our relationship with animals that's not necessarily to do with us eating them, but it's basically just to do with cohabitation. And we talked about cows earlier and the fact that a cow might have intrinsic worth itself. But of course, a cow is, for want of a better word, the cow that we know now is pretty much a human invention of agriculture, as are, you know, the vast majority of domesticated animals. But then, you know, you could take that a step further. And for instance, in this country with deer, and you talk in this book about in Africa, in South Africa with elephants, these things are managed to enable the cohabitation of humans and elephants within the same area. And clearly, you see the way that this is done by basically culling the elephants as being a problem. So how would you see this being done differently?
Yeah, I think the parallel here might be that, you know, we humans are also live in different environments. And we have urbanites, people who live in inner London and live a very different life than, say, the nomadic Bedouin of the Middle East. And other peoples who live in much more rural settings. And yet, of course, we don't discriminate them in terms of the moral treatment. And in the case of cows and pigs and chickens, absolutely. Those animals have been genetically manipulated for generations, and the average American turkey now cannot mate with another turkey because they grow so rapidly, they don't have the physical ability to do so. Does that mean they're less sentient? And I think that's, again, where the rubber meets the road. That's the key issue. And I don't think that changes their sentience level. So I think they, even though we may categorize them in a different way, a pest, a pet, a source of food, and we are very good at categorizing and treating others differently based on those categorizations. Just as in the past, we had colonialism and slavery and subjugation of women's rights and civil rights. Again, we were categorizing within our own species and treating individuals different morally. But I think, you know, the reason we've largely conquered those past moral wrongs is because we recognize those other individuals are essentially sentient like us. They're our equals in that case, and they are therefore worthy of moral consideration. I argue that many other animals are our equals in the sentient sweepstakes, and therefore they too are worthy of that moral consideration.
So in the same way as farmyard animals have been genetically groomed to be suitable for us for our consumption, a similar kind of thing has happened with animal testing, where animals have been bred for testing. But you make an argument, a case, you know, against animal testing. So I was just wondering if there's any conceivable situations where you would think it was acceptable to test on animals, or whether you think it should just be banned or...
Yeah, I would try to uphold the same standards we uphold for our own species. I mean, humans can be used in clinical testing and clinical trials, and the disadvantage for the animal is that they won't give consent, and we can have consent systems. So I certainly don't argue for the cessation of research and getting information about with some medical relevance. But to the degree that animals could be involved in that, my criterion would be the same as we'd apply to humans. The animal shouldn't be harmed. It should be in the interest of the animals. And we can advance science by doing that, and we do. And I would argue that we get the best medical information anyway from the clinical studies with the humans. So it doesn't paralyze us in terms of medical progress. In fact, I would say we'll do better if we do away with the animal testing, putting the animals in the cages and using them as so-called models for humans, and instead focus our energies on prevention, which is through healthier living, which relates to animals and animal consumption. And also things like epidemiological studies, which is why we know that smoking causes lung cancer and things like that. So those sorts of, and there's many other areas, and that's the group that was mentioned earlier, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. I recommend people look them up because they're very strong on bringing to light the science that shows that we have other ways of doing these things.
We're out of time. So, Jonathan, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks to you both for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.